Yo, yo, welcome to Highway Diary. I'm your host, Eric Hollerbach. With me, Ben Hoffman.
What's going on?
New Orleans comic. You know, you moved here from St. Paul, Minnesota. What I want to know is, why did you choose New Orleans and not fucking New York City or Los Angeles, you know? Why was New Orleans calling you?
Have I not told you?
No, no.
Oh, shit. Actually, I didn't choose New Orleans. My original plan was I was going to move to Austin to do comedy. I just kind of wanted like a warmer climate and you know, a place where there was an established comedy scene. Heard good things about Austin. And then I drove down with a friend, and you know, we were planning on moving to Austin for a long time, but we couldn't find housing there. I drove down with a friend. We were on our way to Austin, but we also brought two people along with us because they just wanted to visit New Orleans. They knew we were going south. So we drove all the way down to New Orleans in one night, straight shot. It's like a 22-hour drive. And everything went totally fine until right when we got off the highway in New Orleans, there, like, two blocks off the highway, two blocks from our destination where we were going to stay for like a week or so, the exhaust pipe from my car fell off. It just fell completely off. Like, not like the tailpipe, like the exhaust, like going from the engine to the back, fell off. Had that happened on the highway, it would have like shot up into the bottom of our car, and we probably, you know, would have been in a horrible accident, maybe fucking died. But it didn't, because we were going slow. And then there was some rope in the car, so we just roped up the exhaust pipe, like, climbed underneath there, and then drove it the final two blocks to where we could, like, unload all our shit, because I couldn't even call AAA, because we had all of our belongings. It was completely packed. There were bikes hanging off the back, like, on a bike rack. And then me and my friend just kind of like jokingly at the beginning, we're just like, I guess this is a sign, you know, we're supposed to live in New Orleans and not Austin. We don't have a place to live. And then it, like, that really hit us. And we had like this religious moment where it was like, why the fuck would we not live in New Orleans? This is a sign from the universe. And then we did. We just stayed here.
That's fucking crazy. So there was no plan. It's just, that's where your car exploded. And you know, Austin, it was too much of a pain in the ass to find housing that was affordable. And here, good scene, good comedy scene.
Yeah, good comedy scene. Do what, like, you want to do. Gave it like a few days of a testing period and then like kind of checked out the comedy scene. And I was like, oh, this is actually something that's fucking on. This is awesome. I'm just going to stay here. Everything worked out perfectly. We found housing way quicker. Coming down here to start, we were going to start our moving company in Austin. Where we had, there were two of us that came down, and then we had a third partner also from Minnesota who is near Austin. We were going to start the business together. And when we were finally like, yeah, let's just live in New Orleans, we had to call him and make sure everything was going to be cool. And we're like, hey, you know that thing we've been talking about for almost a year? What if we don't do that and we just live in New Orleans and start the company here? He was like, yeah, fuck it, I'll be there in a couple weeks.
So three of you started a moving company. That could be like almost a sitcom.
Yeah, basically.
So what do you guys do? You drive down there, people rent a truck, and then you help them move the shit in. Then one person goes in the chase car so that after the job is done, you can drive home?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. God, that sounds like a good game.
Yeah, we don't even drive the truck. It's fucking awesome.
How do you advertise? How did you get that shit out there? What's it called, though? Plug your moving company.
I don't want the name of my moving company associated with anything that I actually think, so fuck that.
Yeah, I've been a bit of a loudmouth my whole life, and I'm working on it. I'm trying to do less of that. Like, especially when I'm talking about very serious things. Like, anytime there's a conversation, a serious conversation about, like, gender or something like that, and there are actually, you know, like, women around, I'll try and, like, not, you know, pipe up too much, because I don't want to start mansplaining. Oh, you guys don't know what mansplaining is? Well, Nietzsche would define mansplaining. is exactly what I'm doing right now.
So you have like a socially aware like comedy style. I find that like a lot of the jokes you do, they're like, and I'm not bashing you. That's good. Like, you know, they're like socially conscious and like you're like a vegan and stuff. You talk about having white guilt and try to. Like, is that like a St. Paul, Minnesota thing? Like, what was the scene like in St. Paul, Minnesota? How did you kind of, like, come to that? Is it just your education?
I mean, I never, like, set out to be that, like, a socially conscious mm-hmm. comic or anything. And, like, I still barely feel like that. Like, but I guess it's just something I think of. It's not like the scene in Minnesota is... like that.
I've never been there, so I can only see vicariously through you what that's like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, like, I get, like, if I were to, when people come up to you and they ask you, like, what's your comedy like? Is it, like, political, or you do, like, one-liners? Like, I guess it's more political than anything else, but that's just, I guess that's where my brain goes.
Right.
And it's not even about, like, politics. Like, I haven't watched the news in like, a really long time.
Right.
So it's just kind of the things I'm thinking about, you know, the things I think might be worth saying.
So you try, like, when you're writing a joke, you're like, is this important? Will this, like, you know what I mean? Like, you don't want to, like, I don't know. I heard Eddie Izzard say that. He's like, at the beginning of my career, I just wanted to be funny. But at the end of now, I think about, like, is this important that I'm writing this? You know, will this do anything? Or is this just like, you know?
I mean, I think about those things, but I don't think about them when it comes to specific jokes. I'm not like, am I saying something with this? Like, I don't really care. I guess that just tends to be the things that I think are funny. And probably my best jokes aren't even about that kind of stuff.
Right. But you seem like a socially aware comic. You have on your Facebook page, you're trying to give money to the people of Poa in Hawaii because they had a volcano explode. You know, you're out there, you're seeing what's going on.
Pahoa? Yeah. I lived in Hawaii for a while, and the town nearest where I lived, so I lived in a shack in the jungle, but the town nearest where I lived is called Pahoa, and there's a volcano that's going, and it might, you know, destroy the entire town, so.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's happening, like, right now.
All right, well, people, send some money to Pahoa, you know? You don't want all those...
Yeah, absolutely.
Save
the punatics.
Actually, have you ever had poi?
Yeah.
I've had that, I could do without poi.
Yeah,
maybe it's an aquarium.
It's entirely bland. It's, like, it's really not that good.
It's just like... the consistency of ice cream, but just like zero, no flavor.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know why it's such a big deal.
Yeah, it's like, are mashed potatoes too exciting? Try poi.
Yeah. You like the mushiness? But like, they can't even, could they throw like roasted garlic into it? There's so much things that they're not doing a poi, which I really think is a shame. But anyway, so you were hosted Bits and Jiggles in Siberia. That's my favorite show. I think No offense, but I think Bits and Jiggles is my favorite stand-up show to do in New Orleans. I haven't done the fucking Howlin' Wolf on Thursday, and I'll try that. But that's just a great show. It's always good to have a couple comics and then have some burlesque. I mean, you know, it's a good way to... It's fucking crazy. There's nothing like that in L.A. So how did you get with the fucking... to host that?
Honestly, I think the person who just normally hosts it backed out last minute, and then the guy who runs it just messaged me. He was like, hey, are you available to host? And I've hosted it a couple times. It's always fun.
That's cool, man. So you, like, immerse yourself. You've only been here 7 minutes, and you're fucking, you know, running shows and shit. You got the Always Lounge, which is on Saturday. If you're a comic or if you like comedy, you're in the New Orleans area. Every Saturday at 7:30, sign-ups at 7, go to the Always Lounge. This is by Ben Hoffman.
Yeah, and Paul Oswell co-hosts it with me. He does way more work on it than I do.
What do you mean?
Alternate. Like, he started it, and then I kind of just kind of, like, hopped along.
Mm-hmm.
But he does, like, most of the promoting. And we alternate weeks hosting, but yeah.
Cool.
Shout out to Paul Oswell.
Look at that guy. So we're doing a podcast right now. You put the shout out on the Facebook
shout out
recently, and you said, anyone want to start a podcast with me where we talk exclusively about Point Break every week?
You're trying to tell me the FBI is going to pay me to learn to surf.
Special Agent John Utah, day number one in L.A., welcome aboard. And you are now in the bank robbery capital of the world.
Everybody freeze!
Everybody move! Put your hands up!
We are the ex-presidents!
Now the ex-presidents are the best I've ever seen, ever.
I'm not a crook!
You want to name the bank robbers and be a big hero. The ex-presidents are surfers.
Why Point Break?
Because Point Break might be the most entertaining film.
I mean, it's got skydiving, it's got surfing, it's got bank robbery. It's like, bro, you don't want to surf anymore? It's about riding the wave.
Yeah, no, it's... I will never get tired of watching that movie. Yeah. Like, people are like, oh, is that the bank robbery movie? Or is that the skydiving movie? Or is that the surfing movie? It's like, it's all three. When I, like, put that on Facebook, I guess, it was inspired by, I guess there's this guy who does a podcast, and I think it might be weekly, and he's been doing it for years, where all they do is analyze the novel Ulysses by James Joyce. It's like, Joyce is writing on, like, a level that most people can't fucking understand, so, like, every single word, every single letter, he's really into numerology, so, like, the amount of numbers in a sentence, like, makes a difference. So, but, like, the idea is that through this podcast, through understanding Ulysses to completion, you can understand the meaning of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just, like, joking about that with my friend, and I was like, what if you did that with Point Break? And you got to the meaning of life just shit Keanu Reeves says.
When he's saying, like, yo, are you gonna rip this fucking wave, bro? Like, when you really think about it, like, it's just about, there's people that get on the wave, and then there are people that don't doggy paddle fast enough, you know?
Yeah. Utah, two subs. Why two subs? What does that say about my relationship with my parents?
We're talking about solid professionals.
I need you to teach me.
Give me a break.
It's a place where you lose yourself and you find yourself. You don't know it yet, but you got it. It's right there.
I'm drawn to it.
It'll take you to the edge.
Yeah. Let's talk. Now, how many syllables are in that sentence?
Right.
You want to ride the wave, bro. Okay, let's really get the numerology.
People don't realize all of Point Break is in iambic pentameter.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, man.
You want the ultimate. You gotta be willing to pay the ultimate price.
Forget about it. They are ghosts.
So here's something else from Facebook, and that's a good way. I mean, the NSA is on Facebook. That's, I mean, I've had a few conversations with you, but it can really speed up my knowledge of where you're at in your head.
It's like a Wikipedia page that everyone has, and only they get to edit.
Exactly.
Awesome.
So you said this one night, and I think there's a good story behind this. You said, I was not allowed in a strip club in Baton Rouge tonight after the show because I looked too scuzzy. Maybe it's time to invest in some sleeves, or maybe it's time to take anything, or maybe it's time to take anything seriously. So you were turned away from a strip club in Baton Rouge. That's weird.
Yeah, I had never been to a strip club, and me and some comics went to Baton Rouge to do a show, and like right across the parking lot is the Penthouse strip club over there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, fuck it, we all had good sets, like let's go check it out. And I wasn't wearing sleeves, so they didn't let me in. And I was with someone with dreadlocks. Like, the visual standards for getting in that were absurd.
Now, let's go into what that means. You don't wash dreadlocks. Because if you wash dreadlocks, the dreadlocks fall apart, right? So that is an unwashed head. And, you know?
I mean, I'm not entirely familiar with how that works. But, like, when it comes to, like, what society thinks about how a person looks, I feel like seeing just a guy without sleeves is not, like, ridiculous, but you see a white dude with dreads, and you're like, that's a little crazy.
Right.
Whether or not that's deserved, probably not. But
I
still,
mean,
like, that guy's totally, yeah, just come on in, and, like, me, without sleeves, it's like, no, this is a classy operation.
But it's like, women have, like, their fucking thongs, like, with their pussies, like, bushing out of the fucking thongs, you know, and you know, it's like, look, your sleeves are really, like, harsh in this whole vibe, or, you know what I mean? Or lack of sleeves. What the fuck is that all about? So, we talked about your politics. Do you kind of, like, see trends? Do you get worried that we're kind of going to, like, a more, like, militarized, like, situation? Like, what do you think's happening with, you know, like, are you optimistic politically in, like, the next 5 years? What do you think's going to happen to the country?
I mean, I have no idea. I mean, it's definitely becoming more militarized. I grew up in St. Paul, and they had the Republican National Convention there in 2008. Mm-hmm. And just, they shut down the fucking city. There's, like, people in, like, Ninja Turtle-looking outfits, like, just playing with weapons to disperse people that are like, Bush sucks. Let's not do that again.
Right.
And, like, they can do that on a dime. I guess, like, when it comes to, like, the question of optimism and the future and politics, like, I don't think you can really be optimistic about the political process. You can only possibly be optimistic about, you know, human beings changing, whether or not that's going to, like, that's probably not going to happen, but, like,
yeah.
It, like, people have to change before the world stops reflecting how shitty people are, you know?
Yeah. I was saying this in the last podcast, too. It's like, all my friends, I did a bit about it, like, all my friends are, like these, they, like, study liberal arts, or they're, like, very socially aware, and they're, like, thinking about, like, oh, yeah, go women's rights, and they're, like, don't want to offend anybody. But when you talk about a revolution, like, if we really did, like, there was undisputed evidence, like, you know, like, sorry, I'm jumping all over, but Ben Franklin said that we needed a violent revolution every 20 years in order, like, the blood of patriots and tyrants was, like, the lifeblood of, like, liberty, you know what I mean? Like, and we haven't had a revolution since 1776, so we're, like, you know, how many hundreds of thousands of tyrants, by his estimation, should have their head chopped off? And, like, nobody's got the balls to do that anymore, you know what I mean? Like, what if we do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the French Revolution happened and stuff like this. What is the American Revolution even going to look like if everybody just gets tear gassed the second anybody has a good idea, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, there is the insurmountable opposition aspect of it. Like, yeah, the government totally could squash whatever they want to go on. And there's the people are comfortable aspect. And then there's also the aspect of, I don't think that many people really want to kill anyone.
Right.
And that's all fair.
They used to do that shit all the time, you know, in the medieval times. There was a lot of killing, like, you know, like, now we're totally comfortable with, like, killing people with a drone for, like, stealing oil from a sovereign country. But when it comes to, like, taking that shit home and getting medieval on some cocksucking fucking senator who's, like, institutionally fucking everybody with, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, we're like, less into, like, chopping that asshole's head off.
We're less into that. There are definitely people that would want to, probably couldn't pull it off, I guess. I think, like, there was, like, in the 60s, people thought, like, oh, revolution's gonna go on. Right. And I think the people that were smartest about those kind of ideas, like, it all ultimately failed in some ways, succeeded in some ways, but the people that were smartest about it were, like, the yippies, who were like, let's just be absurd about all of this and just mock the terms at which people are even playing. And, like, just use, like, humor to try and, you know, get everyone on board with the idea that everything we're doing is stupid and no one's even having fun with it. So let's have a more fun, you know, alternative. Let's build a society that could be, you know, in opposition to this, but better. Like, I one time I ran into Michelle Bachmann at a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, just the sight of her pissed me off, as it would most people. And one of the biggest regrets in my life is there was a pie nearby. Like, it was a restaurant, but there was also, like, a bakery. There was a banana cream pie that I could have thrown in her face, and I didn't. And it's like, that's the kind of revolutionary,
right, air quotes,
political statement that I want to make. It's just like, these guys are kind of fucking dumb, right? Let's all, you know.
Just pie them in the face.
Lampoon them, either for the idea of that actually changing things, which might be absurd, or just because fuck them. Why not?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't want to get all gory and stuff, but I don't see a way in which, like, revolutions happen. Revolutions tend to be bloody, and I kind of think that we're, like, really overdue for one. I don't want to murder anybody, and I'm like, I know too much about poetry to, like, have the means of murdering anybody. But what I'm saying is the sentiment I agree with, and just the fact that we got to, you know, like, we spent $1.7 trillion in Iraq, and it would take $60 billion to pay for every American's college education. So, like, $1,700 billion in Iraq stealing oil, and it would take 60 of those to, like, pay for all their college education. But instead, they want to keep all the people down in debt and, like, fucking not knowing what to do. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I want college to do anything with my life, but then I'm going to have to accept this, like, deal with the devil first, and then, like be treading water for the rest of my life after that. You know what I mean? It's like, but we got plenty of money for fucking drone murder, pumping chaos energy into the fucking stratosphere, you know?
Right. But I feel like anyone who would be at all receptive to what you just said is already on board. Like, it's very hard to convince someone who doesn't see the world that way of something like that. So, like,
that's why with people, what's his name? Phuket or, I can never say his name right. The comic that we were hanging out with after Ohio. Oh,
Puneet,
whatever, yeah.
But whatever.
Puneet. No, but I was talking with him one day, and he was saying, like, whatever, however, like, you think that they're sociopaths and, like, intentionally evil, I think that's just incompetence. And I'm like, how can you be president and look at those numbers that I just described and not be like, I'm going to change that tomorrow, I'm going to change that the next day, and, like, you know what I mean? Unless you're a fucking sociopath, unless you're controlled by some kind of banking monopoly or oil oligarchy that we never see behind the scenes, it doesn't make any sense that the president wouldn't
change those numbers. It's not even like it's really behind the scenes. I feel like people know, yeah, like that.
You know, right.
Politicians are controlled by moneyed interests and
all of that. But how do you fight that? What do you think? With comedy, with pies in the face?
Who's going to pay for the pies, you know?
Good point. Louis C.K. was in town, and you were one of those people that got to perform a show with him, right? Was that like being blessed by the Pope?
Fuck the Pope, but...
Yeah, fuck that.
No, it certainly was cool.
Did you get to hang out with him at all, and exchange any words or anything?
No, the only exchange was just like a short handshake, like, hey, you're funny, and it was like, hey, you too.
Oh, that's nice.
No shit. Like,
that's cool.
But yeah, it was just a short little thing, but it was one of the funnest nights I've had doing comedy ever.
Of course. I had people know this who are huge fans of my podcast, but around episode 40 or something, I had Tom Rhodes on my podcast, and I met at this club. He was doing my local club. It was called Flappers in Burbank. And I was like, hey, Tom, you think I could get 5 minutes on your show? And, like, so I was hanging around for both shows, and because I was going to drive him back at the end of the night. And so he gave me 5 minutes, and I couldn't have eaten more dicks faster. It was like the fucking hot dog eating contest of, like, eating fucking shit. I'd only been doing comedy, like, stand-up comedy properly for maybe 4 months, and I was just not ready for the situation that I was asking for.
Uh-huh.
And then, like, I, like, bombed so hard, and it was, like, I meet one of, like, my comedy idols, Tom Rhodes, who's, like, the classiest fucking guy. I did my podcast, and, you know, he didn't know me. He's, like, such a gentleman the whole time. I, like, you know, it was really great. And then I ate such shit, and it was, like, fucking... So, like, to, like, do good on stage with, like, fucking Louis C.K. would be fucking awesome, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it felt good. It was, I did a 5-minute set, and like I was already booked on the show. It's not like
there
was like any reason it happened. It was just like weird circumstances. But like, yeah, for, I do 5 minutes all the time. Like, I know I can do five. Right, and there was a receptive crowd, so it went well. And like, yeah, it felt great though.
But what was the comedy scene like in St. Paul? Like, did you, you were there for like...
I was doing comedy for about a year before I left, and it's an amazing scene. There's like 4 comedy clubs, including Acme, which is like nationally renowned as, you know, one of the best comedy clubs in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And like, there are people that have been doing it for so long there. There are open mics where like 100 people show up. It's
oh really? So
or like sign up? Yeah, it's wow. It's amazing.
Yeah,
but like it's hard to start out in any established comedy scene, I'm sure.
Right, because there's like really when I moved here, I saw that there was shows and I was like okay, but then I get here and I'm like there's not one like comedy club. That's just like a building that's like all they do is stand up comedy. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
In New Orleans, and I was kind of like really surprised by that, where it's just kind of like these little bar shows that like are mostly music venues that
I mean, I tend to think that it would be fucking awesome if New Orleans had a comedy club. There are other people I've talked to in the scene who I respect a lot that are like, maybe it's not ready for one, but you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder if there was one like before Katrina or something, and because I know that. But when Katrina happened, there was like 600,000 people here, and now there's only like 400,000 people here. So maybe there's not quite enough people to sustain a comedy club.
Right, but the height of the bikes has increased twofold. Now you got 2-story bikes. So yeah,
2-story bikes. What are you talking about?
Have you been to the Marini? There's a lot of tall bikes.
Yeah. Those are old timey bikes. So when was the moment when you decided like, oh, I should probably do comedy like, and it should be a big part of my fucking life all the time? What kind of, when did that click for you?
I started doing comedy, when I moved back from Hawaii to Minnesota, basically because I ran out of money in Hawaii.
What made you go? Was it like a shamanistic adventure? What made you go to Hawaii to begin with?
The first time I went, it was because I was dating this girl who wanted to go, like work on a farm for like work trade somewhere. She wanted me to go with, and I was like, yeah, that sounds fun. And she was thinking like Vermont or something. And I was like, fuck that. Hawaii is in the United States. We can just go somewhere beautiful. And went for a few months and then, came back cause that was like the whole plan, and then I missed it a lot, so I moved back there kind of just with the connections I had already made the first time and lived there for about a year, but then like it was so amazing that it got to the point where it was like, if I stay here any longer, I'm never gonna do anything in my life. I'm just gonna live on the beach because this is perfect.
Right.
So I, it was like that, and I was like running out of money also. I was like, okay, I'll go home for a while. And I moved back to Minnesota. I was just kind of bored, and I had always been really fascinated with stand-up, and then went to one open mic and then decided, oh shit, this is what I want to do with my life. So
yeah,
just kept doing it.
Wow. So the first time you did it, it did it go okay, or what, you know?
It went well. In my memory, at least, like, I imagine if I watched the first set I ever did, I would be like, that is fucking awful. But it felt amazing. And also, it was at Acme, Acme Comedy Club, and there's like 200, 250 people or something like that that show up for just the open mic.
Whoa.
So it was a packed house, and it's like, it's a lot easier to perform.
Right.
To a lot of people, you know, laughter spreads and everything.
Yeah, for sure.
So, it felt fucking awesome, and then I started going to open mics at, like, restaurants where people don't know there's gonna be comedy, and dive bars and all that, and started eating shit, and be like, oh, okay, I'm not inherently hilarious, I gotta work on this. That was kind of a fluke, because I had a great audience.
Mm-hmm. So you were, like an indentured servant on the farm. Tell me, what were you doing on Hawaii every day? You were like picking coconuts, or what was your?
Yeah, climbing coconut trees and tending to fruit trees and growing vegetables and.
And they weren't paying you, or
harvesting like ginger and turmeric. Yeah, it's work trade. So basically, like, I got to live for free and eat for free in exchange for.
Right.
Like, minimal labor. It's not like I was, like, working super hard. So I did some of that. And then also there was a lot of just, like, living. Cheers. There was a lot of, like, living out of my backpack and just going and pitching a tent on a beach and meeting people. And
right.
Eating mangoes that I found and shit like that.
It's pretty fucking special over there. And then I've been to... Maui, and I've been to Kauai. And
those are I was on the Big Island. Oh, that's okay. Where Pahoa is. Send some money there.
Yeah, so the Big Island, might, the whole thing might explode, or just Pahoa is in danger?
It's not like the whole thing's gonna explode. I mean, and like...
It was made with volcanoes, so they're always kind of like leaking a little.
Right,
like,
and there have been towns that have been wiped out on that island before. Like, I'm not an expert, so like, I don't want to... speak like I know everything that's going on, because I haven't even been keeping up with it enough, especially considering there's people I care about over there.
Right.
But yeah, this particular lava flow just happens to be going towards like a pretty highly populated place,
and it's like just like slowly creeping up.
Yeah,
on
it's
them, and that's
super slow. There are like some scientists, I guess, that think there might be ways to divert it. But there's really, like, not a whole lot you can do. It's a giant...
It's coming.
Yeah. But it just kind of, like, creeps up.
Right. You can't, like, make a trench or something to kind of funnel
it. I have no idea.
Yeah. That sounds...
And, like, I don't even mean to speak blasé about it, because, like, it's fucking horrible what's going on.
And that's the thing, like, my generation, like, if we can't, like, move a lava flow out of the way, like, we can't have a revolution. Like, you know, I'm like a delicate modern gentleman. Like, I want to, like, have the spirit of, like, guillotines in the streets, and I think that's very needed, but can I pull that off? No, I'm, like, kind of, like, really squeamish when it comes to blood things, you know what I mean? And I can't move, like, I don't want to do all the shoveling it would take to, like, divert a lava
flow. I've never even fired a gun, man. I'd be useless in a revolution.
I have. Gun ranges are pretty fun. I think they're... So what do you think about gun rights and stuff like that? Do you think that we should...
Fuck them, don't have guns. That's kind of what I think. Like...
But the problem, you know, if you make guns illegal, you know, it's like prohibition. It's like when they made booze illegal, everybody just drank way more.
I'm not even talking about, like, legislation, because I have no ideas when it comes to, like, practically how to solve any problems or legislate anything. I just think, hey, don't have a gun and you'll, you know...
Shoot less people.
You'll shoot less people, probably get shot less. But, like, also, fucking, like, privileged... white guy grown up in mostly a safe environment saying that, like, so I understand, like, there are some people that have faced huge violent threats that feel like a gun is going to make them safer. I just tend to think that if less people had them, there'd be a lot less people getting shot.
You might have some pretty good statistics there.
Yeah, I think science might agree with me, but, you know.
Yeah. Did you have, like, a kind of a granola household or something? Are your parents, like, very socially aware, and is it, what's it like in Minnesota? It's a bunch of white people. Let's get that out of the way, right?
The Twin Cities, St. Paul, Minneapolis, like, it's, I mean, majority white, but, like, there's plenty of different minority groups that are, like, doing well, and, like, it's not, like, excessively white or anything like that. The Twin Cities are super liberal, like, very gay-friendly, progressive, so there's that, but, like, my household, my parents are basically just, like, super nice, tolerant people, not overtly political in any way. Right. Not really granola. It was a lot of, you know, just buying the cheapest thing at the grocery store, and that's what we're going to have for dinner and things like that. So, like, they're, like, very accepting and open-minded, and, like, it was more on a personal level that they espoused those sort of ideals than on a political level. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'd be nice to people. And then I translate that as, you know, I guess, like, be a fucking anarchist, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I think fishnet stockings are really sexy, and most people do. They're, like, really fucking sexy. But I don't completely understand why. I think they might just be sexy because society has declared that they are. So we all just kind of, like, go along with that. It's like, oh yeah, I see that. I'm reminded of sex. Sexy. But what are fishnet stockings really saying? I think it might just be like, oh, you look like a sack of oranges, girl. Ooh, you look like you're going to have a fucked up tan line. You look like you're going to have really uncomfortable toes, like there's like a little like sandal thong thing going through like all of them. You know what you really look like? You look like I went to Alaska and like, you know, sacrificed a couple months and I was working on a fishing boat catching crabs, and then like the thing that we caught the crabs in, that's what your legs are in, and those crabs eventually, they're going to be like ground up and put into little cakes, and then we're going to poach an egg on top of them, and then white people are going to eat that for brunch. It's delicious. You're fucking sexy. So I think that's why fishnets.
Have you done hallucinogenics? Did that change you, like, spiritually?
Oh, absolutely. I've done a fuckload of, mostly, like, acid and mushrooms. I've never done, like, DMT or ayahuasca or anything like that. Right. But, yeah, like, there's, if you have a profound experience with that, it's almost impossible to not be changed on.
Yeah. What did you learn from the spirit world? Did you take any sacred knowledge back from acid or mushrooms?
I've never felt like I went anywhere else with acid or mushrooms. It just felt like the things that I actually do experience are, like, more meaningful. And, you know, I think it can open some, like, compassionate doors in a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Not everyone, like, specifically with me, like, I had a lot of, like, anger problems as a teenager before I had done that stuff, and then it definitely mellowed me out and kind of realized, like, everyone's coming from their own anxieties in this thing that we don't understand, and, like, that got highlighted in me, and then through that being highlighted in me, I realized everyone's going through it, so why be an asshole to people?
Right. And if you're angry,
it's very juvenile stuff you learn. You know, and as profound as it feels, you know, it hints at so much more that you could possibly learn. It's like, oh, why don't people know this when they're like six? You know,
right? I the first time I did mushrooms, I was really like convinced. Like, if I had a kid when he was 10, I'm not convinced I wouldn't give him mushrooms and be like, some people take medicine for their body. Like, if you're sick. If your body is sick, this is what I would tell my son, who's 10 years old. I would say, Bobby, some people take medicine.
Your son's name is Bobby?
He is in this story.
Not very creative.
Okay.
Just take more mushrooms.
Okay, Septillion. some people take medicine for their body when their body is sick, or if you're ill, you take antibiotics. Some medicines are for your brain to enlighten you. I'm going to give you, you're going to take this medicine. You're going to go in your room, and you're going to think about your whole life and have some dreams and really discover new possibilities. Okay, Septillion, good night. And then I would get on camera. I really think it's, like, that important for everyone. I'm not sure the science on this. This might ruin
not
his
for
brain.
Not a 10-year-old. Like,
maybe it would make him a schizophrenic, but I...
Yeah, I got a few qualms with that. First of all, just wait a minute until...
What age would that... Because I just thought, like, when I took it, I was like, oh, everyone should do this. And then the world would be such a better place. Like, that feeling and was, like that knowledge that if everyone took mushrooms, everyone would be much better people was, like, super obvious to me. You know what I mean?
I think there's definitely a truth to that, that, like, yeah, if people open their experience to, you know, the drastically different way you perceive your own existence and the rest of existence through psychedelics, that it could help people go about the world in a way that would improve reality. I don't know exactly where I was going with this, but, like, also, have you ever been with a group where everyone's tripping and it still doesn't work out?
Like, what do you mean, work out?
Like, there's still kind of, like, a weird vibe going on, or, like, just no one can figure out, like, how we're gonna get to the next location, or, like...
Yeah, I know what you mean.
There's this, like...
Yeah.
So, I don't think it's the end-all, be-all, but I think it does point to something that you realize is ultimately within yourself, which is, like, this kind of, like, deeper peace, interconnectivity with everything else.
Right. I think set and setting is very important. Like, you're gonna go on, like, a spiral journey. So would you put yourself in a situation where it's, like, the third day of the fucking Metallica concert in Woodstock, and you're, like, covered in
Metallica,
shit, you don't have, I don't know, whatever. You're, like, it's the third day of Woodstock, you're out of food, you're out of water, there's no place to shit, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, you have to, like, hike 2 miles back to your car, you're confused about where you are. That's not a good time to take mushrooms. You know, a good time to take mushrooms is when you don't have work the next day, you don't have anything to do for at least 48 hours, and you, before everybody takes it, they say, what do I want to learn from this mushroom? What do you want to learn? We all, like, have, like, almost a therapy session of what everyone wants to learn. You take it. Maybe you sit on your stoop. Then you come back inside. You have plenty of food and water available. You don't give yourself an obstacle. You know what
right,
I mean?
Yeah.
So that's... You got to respect it in a way where it's, like, you can't have to be, like, okay, let me take mushrooms and then let me drive to the fucking, you know, whatever.
I heard once, I think it might have been on some podcast or something like that, just great advice about tripping, which was, don't trip around people that you might not be comfortable crying around.
Right, that's
it's like
advice.
If you can't be, like, completely honest and naked with your soul around
right,
someone,
yeah,
maybe don't do a drug that'll totally make you feel that way.
Right, yeah. If people are, like, posturing and trying to be cool and setting out this, like, weird vibe where they want to, like, be, like, aggro hipster over somebody else, or, like, or if someone's trying to, like, if, like, you're with your girlfriend and then there's, like, a third guy who, like, likes your girlfriend and then you all do mushrooms, that, the fact that some guy's trying to fuck your girlfriend will radiate to you in 1,000 golden ponies in the spirit world. Do you want to be attacked by 1,000 golden ponies of a dude wanting to fuck your girlfriend? No. So you gotta, like...
Unless those 1,000 golden ponies are like, hey, the solution to all your problems is you guys need to have a threesome on mushrooms right now.
Right. And if you're all okay with that and then crying afterward, that's okay. You know, I'm not gonna tell consenting adults what to do. But you know what I'm saying? Like, there's, you gotta be cool, and there's gotta be no weird vibe in the group, for sure. But I think if you do it properly, if you plan for all that stuff...
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely. You know? I think, honestly, I feel like people are a little bit too casual about psychedelics, especially...
Yeah.
Like, I'm 23, like, kids my age are a bit too casual about it. Sometimes you don't even know exactly what you're getting, especially when it's, like, being sold as something that they claim to be acid. You know, it could be a different research chemical.
Right, right.
I feel like the ban on psychedelic drugs in this country is more a ban on the research of psychedelics than it is on actually having people take them, because they're going to.
Right. It makes it more dangerous. It makes it where you have to source it from a list of people, you know, that are risking getting put in a cage for, you know, taking drugs and stuff, you know.
Right, and so I think if you could be honest and open about specifically what you're getting, and you're knowledgeable about what you're getting into and things like that, and you're in a safe environment where there are people around you that are going to make sure that you have a positive experience, it could benefit almost anyone.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to say anyone because, you know, I haven't met everyone. And I've met some people that I feel like, yeah, you probably shouldn't do it.
Right.
But it could benefit an incredible amount of people.
There's, like, a study about post-traumatic stress disorder, how, like, you know, soldiers coming home from Iraq not knowing how to, like, deal with their life. Like, mushrooms is the, by far, most effective. And just on one dose, on one trip, they come back and they're like, oh, okay, now I feel better about this situation. You can kind of... I think of it like you're like defragmenting your brain. You're like taking all the little blocks of information. And
but I mean,
like
think about
it.
So if they were, if there's information about that, that means it was probably in some sort of controlled study that somehow got funding to be allowed to do that. And those people had supervision because, like, potentially if you give mushrooms to someone who's had a traumatic experience and things aren't, you know, it's in the underground and people are like paranoid about getting caught and all this shadiness that can go along with it, that could just exacerbate trauma potentially.
Right.
So that's why research into these things is like the most important aspect of trying to make this more public, is, you know, making sure that people are doing it safely. You know?
Yeah, and it's...
And I've been at parties where someone's handed me psychedelics and I've taken them and I've had a really good time too, so I'm not
saying.
I have...
You can't do it recreationally or something.
Yeah, and I'm not saying I have the, like, end-all be-all to how people should interface with the spirit world or whatever you want to call it. But I think, in general, the more people know about it, the more people can do it safely, the better it's going to be.
Yeah, you should... I'm just saying you should be responsible. You should pay your rent that month. You should make sure you got water in your house. And then you should make sure you don't got work to do. And that so that, you know, whatever you're going to go on the trip, you're going to be spiraling about the shit that you haven't taken care of. So why have that an issue when you're going in the spiral? You want to directly interface with the divine, and so why have all this other static that is going to be interfering with your ascension into the fucking spirit world? That's what I'm saying, but, you know, what do I know? But I've done mushrooms twice, and both times it were, like, really powerful fucking, like, life-changing things in your life where you, like, really, I don't know. Do drugs, people. What are you doing? Not doing drugs and shit.
Yeah, fuck everything I just said. Just take whatever anyone gives you and do it right now. It'll be fucking awesome.
But also, you know, like with things like MDMA or something, like I hear that, like, if you, you know, there are people that, like, you know, we probably have both encountered where you're like, whoa, okay, you should stop doing that right now. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, like, I hear that as long as you do, like, under, like, 30 pills in a lifetime. Like, every time you do MDMA, it's like you have a card that's getting punched or whatever, and a hole gets popped out of it. You know what I mean? So if you're punching your card every weekend, you know, you're not giving yourself time to, like, replenish the fucking brain cells or whatever.
And then at the end of that, you can just cash that in for not having a personality.
Exactly. Oh, my God. When I lived in Los Angeles, one guy was like, seriously, he came over the house, the most druggy person I've ever met, and was like, okay, how many pills you want? How many pills you want? Okay, so I'll get, like, 4 pills, you get, like, 2 pills, you get, like, 4, you get, okay, that'll be, like, so it's, like, $9 a pill, and he just starts, like, doing this whole auction in his head, you know, because you could tell he was, like, fucking detoxing, right? He, like, hadn't had MDMA in, like, 6 hours, and he was getting jittery, and then he was, like, and then at the end of all this, he's, like, okay, does anyone, like, have any money? I don't have any money. I mean, you're just like, how much more fucking obvious is your issue right now that you're broadcasting? But have you met anybody in your life who's, like, drugs that were, like, an issue? Like, there's a dark side, you know?
It's, oh,
like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's family history of drug abuse, you know, going about as poorly as that can go. And, you know, I have close friends that I feel like have... I've either, like, stopped being friends with them, or they've gone through, like, really dark periods. Yeah, of course. Like, there's always a dark side to, you know, people that are trying to find something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, it's like, it's weird that psychedelics are so misunderstood, because people, they're like, oh, you have depression. Like, people think nothing about taking Zoloft or something like this, and that's like, that's a mind-altering substance that was synthetically generated.
Zoloft.
Were you?
When I was, like, 16, it was bullshit, because basically I didn't like school, and I had got dumped by my girlfriend.
Right.
And so, like, I saw this therapist who was, like, really cool, but then he referred me to a psychiatrist who put me on Zoloft, and I was like, yeah, hey, authority figure, you're giving me a thing, it's gonna make me happy. And I started taking it, and I slowly just lost touch with reality. I started thinking that every single person in the world was not real, and that the only thing I could trust was my own experience, and everything else was just an extension of, like, this grand delusion. It was, like, honestly...
That's trippy.
It was horrible. It was, like, this, like, Gnostic, everything is just an extension of a demiurge kind of thing. And, like, it got to the point where, like, you know, I was just acting strange socially. And I had already had a few positive experiences with psychedelics before that. It made me really happy, but then, you know... Yeah, there's the inevitable come down. And then while I was on Zoloft, it's the only bad trip I ever had. I took some mushrooms, and it put me in this state where, like, those two things just did not jive together. And I thought I was either, like, dreaming or dead. Everything was fake. Like, nothing was real. And I was in this really, like, beautiful park. I thought, you know, possibly I'm dead, or possibly I'm in a dream.
Whoa.
And then I saw that there were, like, some cars parked along, like, just a little parkway, like, and I was like, why would there be cars in heaven? This is bullshit. This is not natural. And so I didn't think anything was real, and I thought if I punched the window of one of these cars, they would all disappear and everything would go back to normal. And I punched out some, like, poor human being's car window because I was so whacked out on fucking Zoloft that, like, I didn't think anything was real. And then after that happened, I was like, oh shit, I might have made a mistake.
Right.
And I, like, walked away. But yeah, like, the antidepressants completely made me lose touch with reality, and then heightened with taking psychedelics irresponsibly, like, led me to do a really shitty thing to another person.
What does a demiurge mean? Like, you thought everything was fake demiurges? What did you say?
Demiurge, it's like a concept in Gnosticism, like, specifically, like, Gnostic Christianity, which is, like, a demiurge is a god that's, like, almost a devil. It's like a trickster god that creates a reality that is fake, and you have to learn the truth to see through it, sort of.
Okay.
I'm sure that's a bastardization of
right.
that concept, but it's the best way I understand it. So.
Now, this is interesting, because the next podcast I'm going to do is a guy called Donald Marshall, and hopefully he shows up for the interview. I tried to schedule it one time, and he said, oh, I'm too hungover, I can't do this interview. But Donald Marshall claims that the Illuminati cloned him, and then when he's in REM sleep, when he's deep asleep, his consciousness gets zapped into his clone's consciousness, and he wakes up in a stadium, and then all of the elites are in this stadium, and they watch him, like, fight to the death or have depraved sex or something, and then he get stabbed, and then he'll wake up in his body, and this happens, like, every night. And I'm very well aware that there's, like, something called mental illness, right? But I'm also well aware that in researching human cloning, you know, I saw this article from 2014, and they're like, we've been doing human cloning for 2 years. And then I saw an article from 2003, and they're like, we've been doing human cloning for 5 years. And so it's like, okay, well, in 2003 you said five, in 2014 you said two, so someone's lying to me. Something's not going on.
I mean, as far as I know, they haven't been doing any of that. So it sounds like bullshit to me.
I saw mainstream articles saying that. But anyway, my point, I just think, like, whatever they tell you is going on, like, we have, like, you know about the CIA, they're like, oh, that's top secret, that's super top secret, that's mega top secret, that's, like, they have, like, security levels of, like, information, like, you know what I mean? I think, like, kind of like a mushroom trip, like, each security level is, like, more completely paradigm shifting, where, like, at the top of it, they're like, actually, everything is a demiurge, and we're run by aliens who have robot chips in our brains, and, like, you know, what is that top envelope, and what the fuck is in there?
And when you move, you gotta get a copy of a key made. You're just allowed to do that. That's fucking crazy to me. Like, you don't have to prove that you live where the key goes, or anything like that. You know, your key, the only thing keeping all of the monsters of the outside world from you, anyone can just make a copy of that. That's fucking insane. There's too much choice now. Like, I could go to Walmart and get a copy of the key made, buy a ski mask, and also get a gun, no questions asked. That's fucking crazy. And, like, if that's legal, like, I don't even know how guns work. I can buy a gun. If that's legal, why even have laws? Like, this city is the closest I've ever been to an anarchist utopia. It's basically that, except for some reason, the one law is that you just can't turn left. All right, I'm about to move on, but I didn't
know. So, have you fallen into any, like, I go down conspiracy holes where I go, what if clones? What if they can levitate, you know, humans? Or what if, you know what I mean? What if, like, you can, like, give double the amount of dicks you have? What if a doctor could, like, give me two cocks or something like that? You know what I mean?
Would you want two cocks for sure?
Are you kidding me? Double penetration with, like, one apparatus? I don't know. That sounds pretty good. But my point is, have you gone down, like, a philosophical hole, or, like, where you just, like, study about philosophers or, you know, Buddhism or anything like that?
So, when I was in high school, I was an asshole. And I ended up getting kicked out. I got kicked out of, like, a big public high school. You know, traditional, what most of the people listening probably went to, like, think of that.
Right.
So I got kicked out of that, and then I ended up going to this, like, alternative hippie-ass school where it was project-based learning. Like, you still had to fit the grad standards of the state, and you still had to do the same amount of work, like a certain amount of hours equal to credit. But you got to design your own projects to mm-hmm. fit those grad standards. And then as a senior, you have to do, like, the high school equivalent of a senior thesis, and mine was on, like, philosophy and comparative religion. So, like, I've always had an interest in that, and I definitely went down that hole. I've done a few meditation retreats where I'll go, it's called Vipassana. I go 10 days without speaking or, like, reading or looking anyone else in the eye or anything like that. Like, it's entirely solitary. So, like, I've definitely swung pretty hard that way in my life.
And does that, like, slow down your brain in a way that, like, mushrooms do too? You know, so that you can, like, have, like, a religious experience or epiphany or something?
Yeah, I mean, like, I've felt about as amazing as I can imagine, like, on those retreats and also, like, doing that kind of meditation. I've fallen off with it. I go through phases where I'm, like, doing a lot more of that. And then I go through phases where, oh, I'm kind of a scumbag, and I'll fucking smoke a pack of cigarettes and drink a bunch of beers and do a podcast.
Well, that's fun, too. You know, it's like, you can't, like, say, like, oh, podcast, because I'm blabbing, I'm not, like, reaching a spiritual enlightenment where I can, like, come for an hour. You know, like, that gets boring, too, you know?
No, yeah, but, I mean, I guess...
Well, would it?
It's similar to, you know, certain things you can experience, or I have. I don't want to speak generally, I'll just speak from my experience. It's meditation and psychedelics have brought me to similar places. And basically, like, the biggest conclusion I've ever come to is, like, oh, it's fine. Whatever is going on is fine. It's happening right now. Mm. And just be nice and it's okay and enjoy yourself. Like, it's so simple and so juvenile, but it's hard to do, you know?
Yeah. I really think that, like, there is kind of a... So, I was watching this lecture that this guy was saying, and he was saying that, you know how, like, the movie The Men Who Stare at Goats, like, the CIA is, like, really into, like...
That guy lives right outside Pahoa.
Stubble Mine.
Yeah.
he lives outside where?
Pahoa.
In Hawaii? Uh-huh. Yeah, so Stubble Mine is, like, he was trying to develop psychic soldiers who can, like, stare at a goat and make its heart explode. And this is a real program that was documented by a BBC documentary called The Men Who Stare at Goats by John Ronson. Mm-hmm. And there's a book, and then it was made...
Was that part of the, like, MK Ultra studies, or...?
Yeah, you know, but I think it's all part of the same thing. They were trying to see if you, well, MK Ultra also involves in trying to make, do mind control. Mm-hmm. So, like, on one aspect, it's like super soldiers trying to take a human and make him into an Ubermensch. And the other aspect of that is take a human and make them into a slave. And they would do that, well... MK Ultra involves, like, doing a lot of, like, traumatic sexual things to somebody and make their personality split. If you, like, you know what I mean? So you would put a person in a situation where they had nowhere to escape, and so their mind splits into this thing where it's like, this is the traumatic details of my life, and this is my everyday existence. Like, you would make two personalities, and then you would, like, program the, like, traumatized part of the brain that can't even cope with what has just happened, and then, like, they would have another personality, which would be their, like, day-to-day personality. And so MK Ultra, like, you know, has a very dark side of it.
I'm Chris DiNicola, born July of 1962, rendering me 32 years of age. I was a subject in radiation as well as mind control and drug experiments performed by a man I knew as Dr. Green. My parents were divorced around 1966, and Donald Richard Ebner, my natural father, was involved with Dr. Green in the experiments. I was a subject from 1966 to 1976. Dr. Green performed radiation experiments on me in 1970, focusing on my neck, throat, and chest. 1972, focusing on my chest and my uterus in 1975. Each time I became dizzy, nauseous, and threw up. All these experiments were performed on me in conjunction with mind control techniques and drugs in Tucson, Arizona. Dr. Green was using me mostly as a mind control subject from 1966 to 1973. His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin.
That thing of, like, you can do anything you want to do, you can walk into a future, like, that positive thinking stuff, that's kind of real, and, like, CIA kind of confirmed that in a weird way.
Of these declassified documents, they're heavily redacted, I mean, lots blacked out, but you get a general sense of what we were doing, and here's what they discovered. And it's not in the published work, it's not in the other videos, it's not in that material, but here's the conclusions after all of it. And I met the Northwest field director, got to know him real well over the years of the Mankind Research Association, the kind of stuff they were doing back in the 70s. And he kept his data. He's got a great box of data talking about all of these experimentations. And what they concluded was that, A, extrasensory perceptions, these odd little things that people could do, were real, not in all instances, but in enough instances to cause them some alarm, military planners. Because what also they discovered is that human beings generally have these innate capabilities that we used to call extrasensory perception. Some have referred to as gifts of the spirit. They come by a lot of different names. But what they are is natural attributes of what human beings are. We're created in the image of a creator. That means more than how we look. It has to do with what we are. And what we are very capable individuals. But in order to reach those higher capabilities, in order to reach those higher states of awareness, in order to actualize your full potential as a human being, you have to be able to slow the mind. You have to be able to create a situation where the mind, if you were to look at it with an EEG and look at the brain activity, you get very coherent, very rhythmic patterns, the kind associated with the emotions of love and empathy and compassion. Same kind of patterns show up. Higher ordered thinking is associated with these coherent patterns, these rhythmic patterns.
But they said you had to like slow your mind down in a way, and that's kind of why I was thinking about that, like being quiet for 10 days would really slow your mind down so you can really like access like your higher self or something like that. So you know what I mean?
The biggest thing it did for me was just like when you shut up, your brain doesn't shut up. And eventually you realize that like that incessant stream of thought, all it is one specific function of the body, like the brain being part of the body. It's just like thought is not that different than like heartbeat or, you know, like blood flow or any physical. It's just a sensation. All it is just something within your body that you experience. And most of the time we identify with thought, you know, we think that thought is what we are. And when you shut up for long enough, you can just kind of look at it objectively and be like, oh, what is it that's looking at the thought? That's me. The thoughts are just thoughts. And like, I have all these thoughts about me, and I've created a me that's an object. I've objectified my own existence, even though I'm the subject of my existence. And like, seeing that and feeling it, like, kind of makes you laugh at all your antics, like a fucking, like, it's the antics of, like, a little child. This is stupid, and you have your worries and your grand delusions and all that. But, you know, it's hard as fuck to live with that kind of knowledge and not get sucked back into thought. Everyone does, you know. But, like, it has helped at least me be able to see that.
The first time I got high, I was with my buddy, and he was like, are you high? He kept asking me, like, are you high? And I was like, I don't know, man. I'm looking at my own brain, and I'm going, are you high right now? And then my own brain is looking back at me like, who are you to judge if I'm high? I'm you, man. I was like, oh, wait, I think I am really high right now.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because where I was, like, trying to be this outside observer of my own behavior, but my observation was myself. So it was this, like, how do I look through my own lens of how I normally am when my own lens has been altered by marijuana to see, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, it's like, at any point of analysis, you're back into pretending to be something.
Right. You know? Let me look at myself like a scientist while I'm stoned out my gizzles for the first time trying to realize what this experience is. You know, it's very, like, it's interesting.
First time I ever got high, I just cooked a pot roast and ate it, and it was awesome. It was just, like, with a bunch of friends, and we stole one of our, it was, like, my friend's dad's weed, and we, like, stole it and smoked it. They were like, oh, we're all really hungry. And all they had was, like, a pot roast and, like, ingredients. And I was like, I know how to cook, man.
So it started with, like, peeling potatoes and, like, chopping carrots?
Yeah, no, I did some work. It was fucking awesome.
The problem with a pot roast is, like, you know, you peel vegetables, you do all this, you have to work for 45 minutes, you put it in a pot, and then you gotta wait for 3 hours. Like, that's the brutal part, you know?
Yeah, but when you're, like, 12 or 13 year old kid, and then you got more weed to smoke, that 45 minutes goes pretty quickly.
That was the first time you smoked when you were 12?
I think I was like 13.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think my first time I was like 18 or something, but I didn't start like, I smoked probably when I was 18 one time when I was 21, and one time when I was 22 or something. And then, like, I didn't really start smoking weed until I was, like, 25. So I said, and then I smoked a lot from 25 to 28. And then I just, like, when I moved here, I put the kibosh on it. But I'll get back on the ganja, but I just needed to kind of, like, make sure that I had, you know what I mean? You just every now and then have to take a big break if anything gets too fucking crazy. But I still have knowledge from the ganja that I learned during my, my love affair with the green bitch.
Sexy, sexy green bitch.
Oh, yeah. So, do you feel like you hurt your brain by smoking weed at 13? Or do you feel like you learned something psychedelic and it helped you? Or what, you know what I mean?
I mean, I can't, you know, I don't know what I would have been like otherwise.
Right.
So, it's hard weird. To say. I don't think so. It's not
should
like
you give mushrooms to a 10-year-old and say, listen, septillion, is that good for his brain or will that make him fucking crazy?
Well, stone 13-year-old me would probably say yeah, but...
I wonder if there's any science. You can't do science on... But, like, what if the answer was if you gave mushrooms to a 10-year-old and then you gave mushrooms to... Like, I'm not saying you give it to him all the time. But once when he's 10, once when they're 18, once when they're 25, like, what if you planned it out where it's like, this is how to make the most awesome human, you know what I mean? But, like, you can't start doing that study because it's all politically incorrect, but you can pump Ritalin through a fucking 13-year-old and everybody's okay with it, you know?
Right, yeah, I mean, like, that is a massively fucked up idea, but it's not actually worse than what happens to children.
Yeah.
Drug-wise, like, yeah. We're not just going to have this one experience that's going to fuck you up. You're going to get prescribed something that you have to take every day.
Yeah. And also, like, look at, like, a newborn baby. They give it, like, vaccines. They give it, like Black Plague vaccine, smallpox vaccine. He gets all these, like, most exotic, bizarre diseases. You
and they
know,
don't even
once.
Give it, you know, ayahuasca.
Right. It's like, let
it's
the baby
up.
Trip, you know?
Give that baby some ayahuasca.
If you were on ayahuasca as a baby and then they, like, circumcised
being
you...
Being a baby probably is exactly the same as being on ayahuasca.
That's true. Because you just look at it, everything was such a novelty. Everything you learn, everything you look around at is new information because those eyes are seeing whatever you're absorbing for the first time.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Nothing's boring yet.
Yeah. That's interesting. What would... Do you think that if all the politicians were forced to take LSD that the world would change the next day?
If it happened at the same time, definitely. Like,
yeah.
It's such a sophomoric idea. Like, dose the president, man. But, like... It might work. Yeah.
But some of those guys...
They'd at least, like... be noticeably, like, different on TV the next day, even if they, like, went back into politician
right.
mode totally, and, like, everyone around them was like, what you experience is bullshit, we gotta keep selling boredom and death
yeah.
to everyone. Even if, like, they had to go back into that mode, they'd be, like, a little bit, like, giggly, at least.
But they would be, like, I think that if a politician... you know, was in a meeting with lobbyists where they were, like, getting a check and in exchange, and they were signing papers about the legislation they would pass, and they were physically handed a check by a lobbyist in their office, and they were on LSD, they would be like, whoa, whoa, this is some heavy shit, man. What the fuck is going on? What is your face even looking at me about? Like, they would totally freak out at the fucking level of corruption that is, like, swirling around,
I mean,
like, toxic city.
That's
know?
Definitely true, but, like, if you gave psychedelics to the entire staff of any organization or, like, institution or like even like a restaurant, that whatever that was would function differently.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. If all of the employees at Subway were on acid, sandwiches would not be exactly the same.
So, yeah, but I think, like, when you're talking about, like, who determines the future of right, our species... Right, so, yeah, the
politics, it just raises the stakes.
I just think those people... I mean, you were saying, like, pie in the face of Michelle Bachmann would be, like, your subtle revolution. I think that kidnapping politicians and forcing them into high doses of LSD, MDMA, DMT, mushrooms... Some kind of cocktail could be constructed from those elements that would be, like, scientifically proven to change the world.
Yeah, it could not at least, you know, slightly make it more hilarious.
Speaking of clones, though, I'm really worried, like, that, like, okay, let's say, you know, old school. It's 1960. You don't have clone technology yet. Maybe you don't. But what you do is... with
so you're convinced there's clone technology right now?
I think, yeah. If you can clone a sheep in 1996, like, and how they did that was they took a cell of a sheep, and then they, like, centrifuged it, and then they put it in an embryo, and then they put it in a sheep's womb, and then they cloned a sheep. Uh-huh. That's what they did.
Yeah.
Why can't you just take a human cell, put it in an embryo, put it in a lady, have it make a baby... I mean, that's just cloning. Like, it's not that fucking crazy.
I mean, when you put it that way with no scientific knowledge...
Yeah. Well, with the scientific knowledge of... I've been going down a clone hole recently. I've been reading everything
would
I can...
Would you go down on a clone hole?
I think... Well, if it was a clone hole, then why not? You know? I would have a Stepford wife. I'm not above that.
I guess. What about, like, a Stepford girl that you're, like, you're kind of dating, but you don't want to say you're dating? So you don't want to, like, put a label.
Would I go down on her?
Yeah, would you go down on her?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm a gentleman.
Uh-huh. Of course.
But I'm worried that, like, what if, like, a politician, like, you know, they shot Kennedy in the head, but what if, in, you know, because he started having politics that, like, the agenda wasn't okay with... What if they, like, a politician was getting a little uppity, right? He was, like, trying to change too much stuff for the bank and, like, the international, like, fucking cabal of whatever you want to call it, of white dudes. What if he was trying to go against that shit, and they killed him, and then they replaced him with a clone that was, like, under MKUltra mind control or something? You know what I mean? So it appeared that he never died, nothing bad happened, but all of a sudden his personality changed overnight, and all of a sudden he's going along with a different agenda. You know what I mean? That's when you start getting into these high level of conspiracy of fucking CIA. You know, you want to go super top secret, ultra top secret, change your paradigm forever secret. You know, when you go up that ladder, anything's possible.
Who's that good at keeping secrets? Like, maybe people. I mean, I tend not to buy into that kind of stuff, but like that. Like, I just want to meet the people that are that good at, like, not saying what's good. Like, that'd be hilarious. You should get a high-level CIA operative on this podcast and just have them not crack.
I would just interrogate them. I would try to, like, confuse them with weird dick jokes and then ask them other questions.
Actually, I'm high clearance and you broke me.
Oh.
What if that happened? It did.
And, okay, so are aliens real? Are they interacting with our government?
Not the government. Just the postal service.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you think you get packages so fast?
It's insane. A stamp's like 30 cents.
Alien shit.
Aliens. Totally aliens.
Yeah, I don't know. So you're not, you're more into, like, you went down more, like, spiritual rabbit holes. That's kind of what you sound like. Can I transcend this plane and go in a fifth dimension? That's more like...
I don't know. My kind of, like, ideas towards spiritual... I guess, like, to your question, yeah, that's more the rabbit hole I went down. But, like... and, like, even, like, when it comes to, like, conspiracy stuff and things like that, like, revolutionary change politically... as far as I could go with that, like in any sort of like thought experiment or like historical research, it just ended back at like, oh, just everyone's got to be better at being people. You know, like that's what the best revolutionaries were saying.
So if you're like a politician, you want to be more corrupt than the last one, like, you know what I mean? You want to be fucking take what, however corrupt you are, Bob McGovern from Nebraska, I'm going to fuck your corruption up a notch, motherfucker.
Yeah, just keep going. No, but like, going down spiritual rabbit holes, it wasn't like I ever wanted to, or even now, like want to like transcend this dimension. I just want this dimension to be as good as I can make it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like
existential philosophy always like tended to be the thing I was most drawn to. Just like, yeah, have responsibility for what you do. You are real. The things that you do actually affect other people, and you're entirely in control of that. Like, you're absolutely a free person making free choices, just, and with that freedom comes the burden of responsibility. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that, like, that's where I've gotten to, at least now, with like going down spiritual or political rabbit holes, I guess.
But, and do you feel like your comedy, you know, you're trying to fulfill that manifesto that you just laid out? Like, where does comedy fit into what your spiritual path?
My main goal in comedy is, like, I just don't want to have a job. That's numero uno. But also, it just seems like communicating with people every single night, if I can just get as good at that as I possibly can, eventually I might learn something about myself that's worth saying to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like, it's some like self-improvement bullshit on a certain level.
Yeah.
You know, like I want to just keep talking and keep trying things out, like see what's funny and what's true, until eventually maybe I stumble upon like the funniest, truest thing that I could stumble upon. You know? And then...
My guest has been Ben Hoffman. You can see him at the Always Lounge every Saturday. Sign up is at 7 p.m. Show's at 7:30. I'm running the Cajuns mic. It's probably only going to last until about Christmas time. So because next semester I got class on Tuesday nights. But Cajun's mic is happening in the short term every Tuesday. Sign up is at 5:30. The show's at 6. And do that. Click through the Amazon link on the Highway Diary RSS feed. Buy some shit on Amazon. It kicks a little some grease back to the show. And this show loves grease.
More like Highway Diarrhea.
Good one. I'm glad you nodded to get my attention for that. This has been an episode of Highway Diary with your host, Eric Hollenbach. Thanks to my guest, Ben Hoffman.
Thank you much, man.
Thanks, brother.